The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Follow us at danproftshow.com for podcasts of the program and on social media at Dan Proft Show as well, Facebook and Twitter. I spoke with University of California at Berkeley Law Professor John Yu yesterday. I asked him what he thought of the D.C. Court of Appeals holding in a 2-1 decision. I'd like to get more information on the one holdout that Federal District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan cannot play both judge and prosecutor at a trial.
I think they reached the right call. If you look at the opinion, it makes clear that the power to prosecute is an executive power. It's given in the Constitution to the president and the president alone. And what the court says is if the president, acting through the Justice Department, chooses to drop charges, the defendant certainly not going to complain. They agree, Mr. Flynn here agreed the charges should be dropped. Then there's no case. And if there's no case, under the Constitution, the courts have no role to step in and force the executive branch to continue prosecuting case that it doesn't want to. So in normal times, with a normal defendant, this would be an easy case. Wouldn't even require all the attention and ever go up to the D.C. Circuit and maybe even to the Supreme Court still. The only reason it's there is because this involves General Flynn and accusations of corruption and the Russia collusion probe, which turned out to be groundless against President Trump.
For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined again by Matthew Whitaker, former acting attorney general of the United States and chief of staff to the attorney general, author of the recently released Above the Law, the inside story of how the Justice Department tried to subvert President Trump, obviously the Justice Department in the previous administration. Matthew Whitaker, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always enjoy being with you.
Did Professor Yu have it about right with respect to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals opinion on the Flynn matter?
Yeah, Professor Yu is a very smart gentleman who was in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Bush administration, and, you know, he knows the law, and the law is very clear. This is not a complicated case. It's very simple. The Judge Sullivan needs to dismiss this case now that the Court of Appeals has ordered him to do that. There is no ability of the judicial branch to conduct a prosecution, and once the executive branch, once the Department of Justice says we're no longer pursuing a case, it's over. And you know, that's the very clear holding of the Court of Appeals case. I hope that Judge Sullivan doesn't press for the full appeals court, what's called an en banc hearing, because then that obviously will lead to the Supreme Court, which will ultimately rule in favor of General Flynn. And so, you know, from what I can tell, this case is over. It should be dismissed as soon as today. And hopefully we can put this behind us and move forward.
I'll tell you what, I don't know if it gets to the Supreme Court. I perhaps would be more worried because Justice Roberts seems to have a little Judge Sullivan in him, doesn't he, in terms of liking to usurp the authority of, in Justice Roberts' case, both the executive and the legislative branch. That's what he did with his DACA decision. These are some strange times where you have to have a circuit court.
I'd be happy to come on your show another time and spend a half an hour talking about how we were all told that Judge Roberts was a conservative and the like.
Right.
You know, but I think people like Justice Alito and others who have, you know, and Roberts, quite frankly, and others that have served in the executive branch, this is really a no-brainer.
No, I know.
Sullivan's making it so much more complicated than it actually is.
I know. This is.
But you're right.
You're right.
It's not a slam dunk.
This is like an episode of Police Squad where we have to have a circuit court of appeals in this country make it clear that a judge can't be a prosecutor on a case in which he's presiding? I mean, what the hell are we talking about here? This is a joke, actually.
Yeah, it's become a farce, and it's too bad, because what this does ultimately is it undermines the people's faith in the system to work. And if it doesn't work for General Flynn, then when, you know, when the lights and the cameras are not on, what happens to individuals that are, you know, can't afford what the type of defense that General Flynn has, you know, essentially personally bankrupted himself buying in order to get to this point. And it's really extraordinary the resources he's been able to bring to bear to get to this point. Most defendants would never have been able to get to this point.
The drip, drip, drip of information about what the FBI and the Department of Justice under the previous administration was doing, more notes released that seemed to indicate President Obama played a more direct role than previously reported with respect to the Flynn investigation and the larger Russian collusion investigation. Kathy Yates, former acting AG, telling the special counsel that Obama broke the news of Flynn's phone calls with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak to her during their January 5th, 2017 meeting. Yates detailed further involvement from Obama. Quote, President Obama said he wants to be sure that as we engage with the incoming team, we are mindful to ascertain if there is any reason that we cannot share information fully as it relates to Russia. Also included in these FBI notes that were released was Comey's description that the Flynn-Kislyak phone calls appear, quote, unquote, legit, as opposed to evidence of some, you know, Manchurian candidate operation that Flynn was the front man for. You know, you wrote a book, Above the Law, the inside story of how the Justice Department tried to subvert President Trump. I assume it's these sorts of notes that we're learning about with each passing week that you were referencing in your book.
Yeah, and I think it is very clear that the White House was involved in at least the prosecution of General Flynn, if not the whole Russian collusion fable. And so I think we have learned more. We now need to understand from President Obama and Vice President Biden more about these meetings they had regarding these prosecutions, because these notes are incomplete. But, you know, one of the things that I noticed is how it appears that Vice President Biden was the one that introduced the concept of using the Logan Act against General Flynn to justify the prosecution or at least the investigation. And, you know, the Logan Act, my recollection, it's never been used. Right. You know, it essentially prohibits citizens, non-government people, not in the executive branch, from conducting foreign policy discussions with leaders from other countries and governments. And so, you know, it's never been, it was passed in the 1700s. I don't think it's ever been enforced as a criminal statute. If it was, then obviously John Kerry and other people that are, you know, running their own kind of freestyle foreign policy would be caught up in that. So, you know, I think Vice President Biden was not truthful in his Good Morning America interview several weeks ago. And, you know, again, if he ever is forced to answer questions from the media, you know, he's got a lot of explaining to do about this meeting and what he recommended for General Flynn.
Given that, do you think it was judicious of Attorney General Barr to make public the position that at this point, based on what he knows of the Durham investigation, that neither former President Obama or former Vice President Biden are targets?
Yeah, so what he said was that he did not have any evidence to support an investigation into Biden or Obama. And, you know, I believe that that's the case. I mean, I don't think these notes suggest any criminality, but it doesn't mean that their evidence won't be developed to justify the investigation. That's called, you know, predication, which the Obama administration clearly didn't think they had to predicate investigations. They just thought they could, you know, send investigators in to interview people like General Flynn and see if they could entrap them in, you know, some sort of a perjury charge. I outline this in my book that you mentioned. It's just how the Obama administration got off the rails as to how regular order at the Department of Justice is done and how we have to restore and how Bill Barr has restored and myself and others, how hard we work to make sure that we do cases the right way. We need to, you know, the rule of law demands that.
And what is your position on the Durham report? Barr has talked about the investigation he believes may be completed by the end of the summer. He, you know, won't be more specific than that for all kinds of obvious reasons. But the idea that the investigation and the recommendations that come from it, including the recommendation of criminal charges, that this is really mission critical and Durham has to have a clock ticking in his mind that this needs to be completed before the election.
Yeah, so I fully expect that John Durham will do whatever is necessary to get results. I mean, I think we were led to believe months ago that it would be, you know, summer, early summer. Bill Barr just said that it would be the end of summer. I expect the first thing we'll see out of Durham is possibly charges brought against people who may have committed crimes, whether that's the FBI attorney that changed a document that was part of the FISA application, or whether that's other intelligence community officials who leaked classified information. But I expect the first thing we'll see from Durham are charges, and then I expect his report will follow on after that. But it's going to be very interesting to see. You know, the American people want accountability, and I think ultimately it's going to be very important to, you know, have a full accounting of what happened, of the origins of this investigation, and then ultimately hold people accountable for violating the law.
He is Matthew Whitaker, former acting Attorney General of the United States and Chief of Staff to the AG. He's the author of the recently released Above the Law, the inside story of how the Justice Department tried to subvert President Trump. Matt, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, it's all right. Even when push comes to shove. Well, it's all right. If you got someone to love. Well, it's all right.
Listen to podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show, sticking on the topic of law enforcement, but moving from the judiciary to the police side. We have another police-involved death, this in Tucson, Arizona. It's sort of interesting. I don't know if this is going to get a ton of coverage or not. It's a little bit difficult to know these days, the cases that galvanize public attention and those that don't. But this was a case involving a call that Tucson police officers, the Tucson Police Department, got to respond to a home where the grandmother said her grandson was behaving erratically. The grandson is 27-year-old Carlos Ingram Lopez. This was an incident that happened actually back in April, but the body cam footage just became available yesterday. The Tucson police chief had a briefing on it, in which he also offered his resignation to the mayor of Tucson, a Democrat named Regina Romero, who said she's contemplating Chief Chris Magnus's resignation, but also said he's an honest and great police chief. Why would you want his resignation? It becomes even more curious and indicative as a sign of the times once you get into this case. So just to give you some of the progression of this body cam video that's 25 minutes long that was released, here's what police found when they came upon Mr. Ingram, who was lying naked in his grandmother's garage.
Where's he at? Hold that door.
No! Get on the ground!
Okay!
Get on the ground!
Just hold him.
I'm sorry, get on the ground.
Get on the ground.
Man, I'm sorry, dude.
All right.
Oh, man. Get on the ground!
Get on the ground!
Okay, please! Please!
Get on your stomach now!
Okay, please!
Get on the ground. Hey, give me that hand, okay?
And that screaming and caterwauling goes on for a bit. It's important to note, you'll recognize this if you watch the body cam video, there was no chokeholds. There was no physical abuse. They were trying to gain control of Mr. Ingram Lopez, put cuffs on him, and that was it. So it's important to note that they were not abusive. In fact, they, from the time they confronted him to trying to get control of him, they were actually room temperature the entire 25 minutes, just trying to gain control of him, trying to calm him down so he didn't hurt them or himself. So a little bit later on in the process, this is 8 minutes later, the officers are deciding whether or not to try to put pants on him. Remember, he's naked in the garage. Or just put a blanket on him and then get him to jail and then put pants on him there. So the one officer calls for blankets. He's got some blankets that are just sort of paper-thin blankets that they want to put around him before they take him from the garage into custody, onto jail. And also, this is the point, and this is being made an issue by some, where throughout, Mr. Ingram Lopez is calling for water. And he calls for water again here, and then one of the officers calls for water as well, tells another officer where water is located in his squad.
In the box bag? On there, there's one in the side pack. Black bag. Black bag, get on zip and there's one in the side pack.
And so you hear him call for water. The blankets are on Mr. Lopez, Mr. Ingram Lopez. And he's just making those noises. But again, all you have is officers like with a hand on his leg so he doesn't kick, with a hand on his back so he doesn't flip up or behave wildly. And he's cuffed behind him. Okay. And then finally, this is now 5 minutes later, as they're debating the transport of Mr. Ingram Lopez, there's a recognition that he's not conscious. And then officers go into trying to revive him.
Hey! Do you have a specific ailment?
He's just not conscious.
Can we get his other arm?
Oh, he's on his name. Can we switch him to the front? 36. You can? Yeah.
Did you get a pulse
yet? Not good. He's open. He's moving a little bit. From like a 9,
can you let TFD know it
have to be
1018? What's that? Is he use drugs?
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Go get an arm.
TFT's going to have to get here 1018.
So you hear them talking about the paramedics need to get there, asking, does he use drugs? Yes. So they administer Narcan, thinking that perhaps he was overdosing. That didn't work. And you see this on the body cam. They begin CPR until paramedics arrive. Ultimately, he doesn't make it. The county medical examiner concludes that Mr. Ingram Lopez died of sudden cardiac arrest with acute cocaine intoxication and an enlarged heart. So he had an enlarged heart, he was on cocaine, and he whipped himself into a frenzy during this incident with police, called to his grandma's home because of his erratic behavior, as you got some indication of from those clips, and he passes away. The three officers involved resigned. The chief said, it's important to note that they would have been fired had they not resigned, and the fact that they would have been fired will be part of their permanent record in the event that they tried to get a job at another police department. There were no strikes. There were no chokeholds. There was no knees on necks. But Police Chief Magnus did say that they would have been fired because they violated police training and procedures, although he wouldn't be specific. Now, the only thing I can think of is that maybe, and this is from our conversation about the George Floyd murder as well, although I'm not calling this a murder, from our conversation, the idea, and I know this from talking to friends on the Chicago police force, that you have somebody handcuffed, so you have them effectively in custody, and you're going to have them in that position for a minute while you're trying to figure something else out, like in a situation, a relatively unusual situation, like the case here in Tucson, where you don't want to leave him on his stomach. You want to roll him on his side for the very purpose of preventing any sort of asphyxiation or health event. You know, maybe that was what should have been done, something the chief is referring to that wasn't done. But was this excessive force? Was this some sort of purposeful harming of the suspect? No, it wasn't. And what do we have here again? And I understand that he was under the influence of cocaine, as the medical examiner concluded, but we have noncompliance, even as police officers throughout the 25 minutes, or at least throughout the first 15 before he loses consciousness, are saying, tranquilo, tranquilo, are you calm now, trying to calm him down. You know, I just think of a case like this, and I go back to the Bill McGurn column earlier in the week. Who would want to be a police officer right now? Take a look at that Tucson police body cam video with some of this backdrop and ask yourself that question, because, you know, if that is something, and by the way, the police chief said, you know, charges may still be forthcoming. They still may be charged criminally. There may have been a violation of police procedure. There's nothing on that body cam video that indicates any malice, any abuse. And frankly, I can't understand how they could be charged criminally. But, you know, it's difficult to make out a felony murder charge against the officer in the Rayshard Brooks shooting as well. But that's what he's facing. This is Dan Proft.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, arguing on the Senate floor for the police reform legislation that he sponsored, that he is leading the fight for the caucus on. He figured something out about the Democrat-Socialist opposition to his legislation. It's not the substance of his legislation that's the problem. You know what the problem is? It's the sponsor.
The actual problem is not what is being offered. It is who is offering it. It's the who.
The who that's offering this. Not the what is the problem. The who is the problem. Well, golly gee, why would that be? Tim Scott offers a comparison to explain why that would be. Somebody who's experienced racial profiling, even as a United States senator, makes a comparison to the sort of profiling that he's experiencing right now from his Senate Democrat colleagues.
I understand that. But what I missed in this issue is that the stereotyping of Republicans is just as toxic and poison to the outcomes of the most vulnerable communities in this nation. That's the issue.
For more on the issue, we're pleased to be joined again by Ryan Bomberger. He is the founder of the Radiance Foundation. Ryan, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Does Tim Scott have that about right, that it's not the what, it's the who? And the problem is he doesn't fit the left's narrative, and so they can't go along with him.
100%. As someone who is brown, who gets derided all the time because I don't toe some ideological line, I know exactly what he's talking about.
Jason Whitlock, somebody else that doesn't toe the party line in the sports world, writes recently, and he's really upped his game recently, "The American media have imposed race and politics as our new religion. Many people who claim Christianity and other religions as their faith have in reality prioritized race and politics well ahead of God. They talk and worship race and politics daily, hourly, from their Twitter pulpits. They use race to evangelize for their political beliefs while rarely ever evangelizing for God." Does that sound about right, too?
That's 100% correct. The Radiance Foundation put out a meme and an article that said Christ before color. And that's the issue we have today. It's such a race-fixated, color-fixated approach, which is the polar opposite of what Martin Luther King Jr. was calling for, which was a gospel-centered approach, that we are one, that we're not color first, we should look for content of character. But that's not what's being pursued right now.
Well, what's your response to the Black Lives Matter movement? And again, here we get into the parsing. I'm talking about the neo-Marxist formal organization with the first letter caps in their name, and also just the general straw man hashtag lowercase letters, the straw man being Black Lives Matter. It's an argument against which there is no counter argument. So how do you respond to both the formal organization and sort of the mishmash of de facto of people sort of de facto affiliating?
Well, Black Lives Matter movement is a movement that has its own manifesto. People keep thinking it's just a hashtag, but the people who created the hashtag explain what Black Lives Matter means, that it's more than just skin color, but it also has to do with political identity, and it has to do with homosexuality. That's from Patrice Cullors, who, in an interview and asking about why they started this movement, she says, "We are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists." This is nothing new. It's just the regurgitation of 60s black nationalism, throw in black liberation theology and critical race theory, and you get the Black Lives Matter movement and its radical far-left manifesto. And as a Christian, there's no way I can embrace that broken secular movement.
I don't have real high expectations, including for the college kids, to know anything about the ones tearing down monuments, the vandals, the looters, to know much about history. The real question is, what is it about our culture that gives license to the kind of behavior we're seeing from some people that are using the cover of protest to engage in the behavior we're seeing in Madison, Wisconsin, and all around the country?
Well, I do need to say that every life unjustly killed deserves justice. George Floyd absolutely deserves justice. So that as the foundation, but that's not what this is about. This is, I call it blaxploitation. They constantly use the death of black individuals and under the guise of police brutality and that there's an epidemic, which there is not if you simply look statistically. But the problem is it is a godless movement. It's no different than in the 60s where Martin Luther King Jr. denounced the black nationalist movement. He denounced Malcolm X because they believed in violence, because they didn't even believe in integration. But yet you had a gospel-centered movement that Martin Luther King Jr. led, whereas you had the godless movement led by Malcolm X and by any means necessary. And we're seeing that reflected today. When you pull God out of that picture, there is no ability to get to that place of forgiveness and reconciliation. And so we're seeing, unfortunately, the rotten fruit of the secular approach that will never bring unity and that will never bring the kind of reforms, some of the reforms that are necessary, but certainly not ever bring peace.
When we come back with Ryan Bombinger, I want to discuss the lack of accountability when it comes to holding big city Democrats in public offices accountable for what happens on their respective watches. More with Ryan Bombinger when we come back.
And it was you.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Ryan Bombinger, and I want to address public safety in big urban centers that are controlled and have been for many, many generations by Democrats. More specifically, why there seems to be a total absence of accountability for what happens on their watch. For example, between Friday and Monday of last week into this week in Chicago, there were 140 people shot and 20 murdered, including a handful of kids who were just caught in the crossfire. And nary a word in the direction of our black female mayor, our black female Cook County prosecutor, our black female Cook County board president, our multiracial city council, you know, those in charge and whose first charge is keeping people safe. And there's no criticism. There's no even questioning of those people in charge. And we've seen this play out in big cities around the country, Detroit and Baltimore and other cities that are beset by gang violence and just violent crime generally. And there's just very little accountability. Why?
Well, because it's easier to blame white supremacy. I mean, if they want to dismantle white supremacy, I guess in some ways I'm like, okay, go ahead. All the institutions that are run by the left, these inner city governors, or the government in inner cities, you're talking about public schools, you're talking about Hollywood, the entertainment industry, mainstream media, the list goes on and on. You want to dismantle white supremacy? Go ahead, dismantle the left. So they're not going to expose themselves, unfortunately. But it just proves the fraud. They want to talk about life loss, and yet the lives lost in all these riots from coast to coast, black lives, like David Dorn. That life doesn't matter. So it's always the some Black Lives Matter. It just, I hope people are awakening to the fraud that is not only the Black Lives Matter movement, but that is the political left.
So is Black Lives Matter, it's like the NAACP. It's really, as Rush Limbaugh famously intoned, it's the NAALCP for liberal people. And Black Lives Matter is only if it's either liberal people, leftist people, or it fits our narrative more generally.
They don't even pretend that it's anything other than a leftist political agenda. If you go to blacklivesmatter.com or the Movement for Black Lives, they make that very apparent. I mean, that's why you see the black fists all over Movement for Black Lives. It's all about a leftist political approach, and it's all rooted in color. See me as a black person first. Know me as a black person simply because of my melanin, and that's all that matters. Black identity, black identity. You can't fight racism with more racism. You want to get rid of white supremacy and replace it with black supremacy? Not going to work.
Do you think if we're going to claw back our country, to its founding principles and live out those principles, those godly inspired principles that are memorialized in our documents, do you think it's going to have to be black conservatives who take the lead. Not to abdicate and say, hey, Ryan, go to it and let us know how it works out. Everybody has to participate, or everybody who wants to has to participate in some meaningful way. But in this hyper-racialized America, unfortunately, that's the case, it's going to be the Ryan Bombergers and you know, the civil rights era folks like Shelby Steele and Bob Woodson and Walter Williams and the Jason Whitlocks of the world that are going to have to be the tip of the spear.
Yes, but as with every movement for, you know, equality, racial equality, it took white and black. So it's not enough. I mean, as a black conservative, as a brown conservative, I get ignored all the time.
Right.
So it's not enough for a black conservative to speak up. We speak up all the time. The problem is oftentimes there isn't the platform there. What we need are pastors in particular, pastors of any ethnicity, to get a spine and speak the truth from a biblical perspective and say, yes, of course, racism is sin, but this is how the church should approach it. This is how our country can approach this. And if we don't get pastors to do that, we don't get politicians. Where's the GOP? Thank God for Tim Scott.
Yeah.
But the GOP has been so silent overall on all of this. So we don't even have politicians that have the fortitude to even speak against the chaos that's been happening. I mean, obviously you have President Trump who's speaking to it, but you don't have the party as a whole speaking. The party of liberation, the party of Lincoln, is not speaking the way it should be speaking. So it's a combination of things, really.
But I mean, I just to emphasize this, because I think this is interesting, and I don't know that people appreciate it, because it's my view, and it's not my view alone. But it's going to be black intellectuals and activists, and yes, clergy and sports writers. It's going to be the charter school operators like Ian Rowe in the South Bronx, and it's going to be intellects like Glenn Lowry at Brown University, or John Sibley Butler, University of Texas, bringing their various expertise to bear and their experiences. Some date back to the civil rights era, and some, you know, obviously are younger. That have to be the face and sort of the moral voice of the movement if you're going to persuade, I think, so many that have been completely race-addled because of our culture. I just think that's where we're at.
Yes, I mean, certainly the conversation can only be elevated by those individuals and by a number of my colleagues, and thank God for Dr. Alveda King, the niece of Martin Luther King Jr., is also speaking into this. And it does raise it, because the conversation from the left is not an intelligent conversation. It's deeply emotionally rooted, and it's not rooted even in common sense. And so, yes, we need these voices to break through this clutter and this noise and to speak peace, true peace, to these situations, because it's so volatile right now. And that's why it breaks my heart to see so many people who should be leading, particularly pastors, who are acquiescing, who are capitulating to a movement they don't seem to know anything about.
It just seems to me, right, you know, leadership builds consensus. And so the riddle that needs to be solved is coming together to elevate the best and the brightest who can lead this revival that I think we're both talking about from slightly different perspectives, but sort of trying to get to the same place. I think that is it. And that's a responsibility, as you said, white and black and every other color under the sun. It's about what's happening between your ears, obviously. He is Ryan Bombergher. He is the founder of the Radiance Foundation. Ryan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
The more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Continuing from our conversation with Ryan Bombergher from the Radiance Foundation. What we didn't get to in our discussion of some of what Tim Scott had to say is some of what Nancy Pelosi had to say, including but not limited to Tim Scott, which is that I don't know, based on what she said, that the entire Senate Republican caucus, including Tim Scott, should be arrested and charged as accomplices after the fact in the murder of George Floyd. You think I'm kidding?
When you were speaking yesterday, you said that Republicans are, quote, trying to get away with murder, actually, the murder of George Floyd. Senate Republicans are demanding an apology for that statement. Will you apologize?
Absolutely, positively not. The fact is, people say, I think you, frankly, in the press have given them far too much credit for a bill that does nothing. They're saying, well, you have your bill, they have theirs. Yeah, our bill does something, theirs does nothing.
Is Tim Scott working in good faith? Is this a good starting point?
I'm talking about Mitch McConnell.
Of course you're talking about Mitch McConnell. Why wouldn't you be talking about Tim Scott, the sponsor of the legislation you characterize as tantamount to participating in the murder of George Floyd? Gosh, what is it about Tim Scott that would make you not want to address Tim Scott, the sponsor and the rhetorical leader, in advocating for at least the debating of, if not the passage of, his police reform legislation, the police reform legislation he's sponsoring with the support of his caucus? Rhetorical questions. This legislation Tim Scott proposed does nothing. First of all, as we know, policing is primarily a local matter. There's only so much the federal government can do. Tim Scott outlined what his legislation would do. Full and account, accurate information surrounding uses of force. He noted in a USA Today editorial, only about 40% of police departments report that information to the FBI at present. His bill would change that. So you have a more information gathering that's accurate, that's comprehensive, that's shareable. Second, the bill expands DOJ grants to better train and recruit officers. Finally, the third part of the bill focuses on the officers who damage the reputation of the entire profession, preventing a disgraced officer from bouncing from department to department without a record following behind him or her, creating an enhanced penalty for officers who falsify their incident reports, surrounding an excessive use of force. So it does some things in the areas where you can do some things as a federal government, as a member of the federal government, on a matter that is primarily a state and even more primarily a local issue, tantamount to murder. The other thing that has to happen for the Republicans, starting with Tim Scott, since he's done such a good job leading on the substantive issue, he should do and taking on those who use racially charged rhetoric to criticize him, like Dick Durbin calling his bill tokenism. Nancy Pelosi now taking that, I'd say, more than one step further and accusing Tim Scott and Senate Republicans of, again, being accomplices to George Floyd's murder after the fact. That statement she made cannot be repeated enough. She and Democrat socialists need to be held accountable for that kind of rhetoric, and that needs to be bumped up against every time any one of them talks about how they're trying to unify the country in the face of a divisive president or divisive congressional Republicans. Tim Scott would be an ideal person to lead on that issue as well.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft. And this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Follow us at danproftshow.com for podcasts and program, and on social media at Dan Proft Show as well, Facebook and Twitter. I mean, the hope that we would learn something from the experience of the lockdowns in March and April and for many states well into May and June, and yet the media is doing the same thing it did in the first quarter of this year when we knew far less about the virus. Don't you find that remarkable? They are re-whipping a large percentage of the population into frenzy and into ignoring any contextual information that would lead to more tempered decision making. We're just going to do it again? The Wall Street Journal points out, yeah, there are flare-ups to almost, and the reporting on them is almost the media feeling they're vindicated in some way. They're almost celebratory. And in point of fact, everybody told everybody so. When you open up, you're likely to see an increase in cases. That's the beginning of the conversation, not the end of it. But the reporting is that's the end of it. By the way, every person who tests positive, particularly of some profile, it's like we're still treating it as like a death sentence. It's reported breathlessly. in a way that you don't report when somebody has some other illness that is non-fatal for 99% plus of the people who get it. Hospitalizations in Texas have doubled in 2 weeks and increased more than fourfold in San Antonio and the lower Rio Grande Valley. Cases in Harris County, hospitals around Houston have doubled in a week. Oh, that's right. But, for example, New York City had about 12 times more COVID-19 patients per capita in ICU at the peak of its hospital surge in April than California does today. 12 times more. 6 times more than Miami-Dade. 5 times more than Arizona. 4 times more than Harris County. In addition to that, the chief operating officer of Tenet Healthcare, which runs hospitals in Sunbelt states, said on an investor call last week, the length of stay on recent cases is lower. The resource consumption is lower. Two reasons. One, they're not as severe. Two, everybody has gotten better at treating COVID patients because of learning through experience. And three, we know that the median age of the COVID infected has dropped significantly in Florida, for example, from 65 to 35. And in those areas that have seen a spike, they're still nowhere near capacity with, for example, ICU beds. Oh, and remember the flip side that we're being told to forget again? New study in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, finds the number of adults reporting symptoms of serious psychological distress rose to 13.6% from 3.9% the same time 2 years ago, quadrupling. Higher levels among the young, 24%, lower income, 19%, and Latinos, 18%. Rhode Island reported this week that drug overdose deaths spiked 22% in the first 3 months of this year. And this doesn't even begin to discuss the 21 million unemployed. We have to reframe the discussion we're supposed to have. It's just staggering to me. But let's get an expert's opinion on it. He is Roger Klein. He's an MD and a JD, Dr. Roger Klein, expert with the Regulatory Transparency Projects, FDA, and Health Working Group. He's a former director of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic and a former advisor to just about every alphabet soup federal agency you can dream up, FDA, CDC, CMS, HHS. Dr. Klein, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, hi, Dan. Thank you.
I wanted to get your reaction to my Jeremiah and to see if I was on point or off point.
Yeah, you know, I agree with everything you said, but there are organized sports. It's tearing down statues, breaking buildings, windows. So there's things to do. It's just that we may not consider them positive things to do. So, no, you're completely right, and unfortunately, the media is really playing a very destructive role right now. We're seeing increases in cases, which isn't even necessarily bad. It's to be expected. This isn't going away. What they are is they're skewed toward younger people. So we have many more infections. We have some increase in hospitalizations, but not nearly as much as the numbers of infections. And we still have declining deaths, again, because the age profile of the people getting infected is less. And as you say, the states that are the primary focus now are way behind, you know, the hard-hit states like New York on a population basis. They're still among the better-performing states in the country in that regard, and their economies are better off. So this notion that somehow letting people go to work, it has been harmful. It's the opposite. These are public policy, not medical decisions. And they're doing a much better job of balancing the considerations than the states that have imposed severe lockdowns.
Richard Vedder, writing in Forbes magazine sort of flying off of a study that came out of the University of Washington this week about the failure of the virtual classroom during the lockdown periods in terms of children's intellectual development, said that closing schools was a grievous error. And Denmark and Norway have agreed that after the fact that Sweden was right in not closing the primary grades for education. Is that your view? Should schools reopen, particularly the primary grades?
Oh, yeah. I think we have to go on with our lives. Now, look, I think it's a good idea to keep kids away from elderly relatives who are sick, quite frankly, when they're going to school. I think the chance that they're going to catch it is much higher. Again, we need to devote our energies toward protecting people who are at highest risk and letting this thing move along, because absent a vaccine, the only way to get rid of it, it appears, is through development of immunity.
Oxford AstraZeneca group is moving to final clinical trials on their possible vaccine. Fauci testifying earlier this week before Congress, maybe by the end of this year, maybe early 2021. So even if there is a second wave, regardless of its virility, probably not going to have a vaccine for the second wave this fall and winter. One, how much promise should we put in the vaccine that people keep talking about on the timeline? They keep talking about it, even with as far along as the Oxford group is.
Yeah, so I think, I'm not a big fan of the metaphor of wave, because I don't see it as wave. I think it's here, it's persistent, it's going to be with us, and it's turning into probably part of our usual repertoire of seasonal infections. So, but yeah, we probably will see more infections in the fall. On the other hand, what we're going to see, hopefully, are decreased flu infections, because separation mechanisms, which is really the only thing that we really have data on that prevents catching it, is distancing yourself from other people, separating yourself. And the literature that we have says, I think, about 2 feet or more, 3 feet, but we're doing 6, which is better. But anyway, that's what I think is going to happen. Now, the vaccines are very promising. And look, you've got to give the president credit. He's been instrumental in pushing things along, both as a cheerleader, but also in terms of the regulatory approach. Moderna, I think, has an extremely interesting concept using messenger RNA. And that's an interesting model, because it can be replicated. The other two there's 3 being tested. The other two are more conventional approaches. And I'm optimistic. And when we have a vaccine, it'll be helpful, and some people will take it and some won't.
Right. What about for kids in school? That's part of the mandate in Illinois, for example, reopening, as kids have to wear masks in school. So now you're talking about wearing masks for an extended period of time, a school day, or masks even. It's been proposed in order to restart youth sports. Those two things strike me as inane.
Yeah, I'm not sure. First of all, I'm not sure it's even realistic, especially for smaller kids. They're just going to take them off. They always have a cold. I don't know. I don't know how you're going to prevent it. You look at little kids; they constantly have colds. It probably doesn't make sense. I don't know what the objective is, and I think people who advocate for that have to explain the objective. My assumption when children go back to school is that they're, once it gets in the population, they tend to get close to one another, especially smaller kids. They're going to get it, and that's what's going to happen. But there's no evidence that there are any that they're especially potent vectors for it. And maybe they will be. My own feeling is, look, you have a child, keep him or her away from grandpa.
I so enjoy the fact that in 100 years we haven't advanced the debate at all on this topic. It's so great how little we learn from history. It's really edifying. He is Dr. Roger Klein, expert with the Regulatory Transferrin Projects, FDA and Health Working Group, former director of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic, and former advisor to the FDA, CDC, CMS, and HHS. Dr. Klein, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Listen to podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show, and we're moving from our discussion about COVID-19 with Dr. Roger Klein, formerly of the Cleveland Clinic, out to L.A., which was part of our conversation, but more specifically, L.A. County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer telling the L.A. Times that it's highly likely that the demonstrations, the protests against police brutality, racial injustice, and the less productive conduct that was done by certain groups contributed to the significant spike in COVID-19 cases in L.A. County. They also saw in L.A. County a positive test rate climbing from 5.8% to 8.4% since the civil unrest, and as well as the legitimate protesting, distinguishing between the two, which is interesting because the sort of narrative was, including from public health professionals remarkably, that if your cause is righteous, the virus and the protocols associated with the virus somehow are suspended. For more on this, let's talk to somebody running for public office in California, running to provide leadership that California is currently lacking. And frankly, Congress is clearly lacking, particularly in the House. His name is Joe Collins. He spent more than 13 years serving our country in the U.S. Navy, and he is now running for Congress against none other than No Justice, No Peace, Maxine Waters. Joe, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, why don't we start with the COVID-19 caseload in California, particularly as you heard me talking against the backdrop of how there was no concern about COVID-19 during the protests and the less productive behavior. And now we recognize that the virus knows not the righteousness of one's cause.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with that because, you know, we've led protests to reopen California, and I've also marched with demonstrators against police brutality, but I've also stood with the police department against violence to the police. And you know what? My health is 100% still. So I agree that COVID-19 gives people who have righteous causes.
Yes. Well, there you go. There you go. Both sides of it. Very good. Well, so let's talk about your race a little bit. I mean, you're just the backdrop here. Maxine Waters got like 78% of the vote in the primary back in March. She got 77% of the vote last go around in 2018. Why are you taking up this seemingly significantly uphill fight against Maxine Waters?
The reason why is because the community of South LA has not had real representation in a long time. You know, a lot of people say that she got certain amounts of votes or whatnot, but we have a low voter turnout in California, so where 78% sounds a lot, only about 150,000 people comes out to vote. But, I mean, people need to know that they have a different option. We had a tough time in the primaries trying to get our race together, but now, you know, we're rocking and rolling. We're very visible. We've done a lot for the community, and people really appreciate that. But I think that everybody knows that it's time for something new. We need better jobs, better education, economic development. We need to rebuild that relationship with the police and the community as well. And that's something that Maxine Waters has not been able to provide in a very long time.
I know you've also been willing to be critical of House Republicans, and that's fine. It's probably long overdue, some internal reckoning within the party. And you specifically went after House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy for being a bit presumptuous when it comes to knowing what the state of play is on the ground in communities like South Central. What was it exactly that riled you about what Kevin McCarthy said?
Well, I watched the Fox News episode that he was on, and mind you, I have a lot of respect and admiration for House Leader McCarthy. But I think one thing that we have to understand is when it comes to inner cities like South LA or Chicago or New York, we don't have Republicans being active in our community. So when I see Mr. McCarthy or any other Republican get on TV and starts to talk about what the Black community needs, especially in the urban areas, it really makes me upset because I sit here and I think about the work that we've been doing on the ground in these liberal cities, in the community, and I've never once seen any type of leadership from the Republican Party reach out to anyone in the cities. You know, it really made me upset, you know, and it's like, you know, if you want to come to the inner cities, please come out here, help us, because we need this leadership. We need to show people who are, we're trying to get the turn red, that the Republican Party supports them just as well as they support everyone else.
Yeah, I think it's a fair criticism, and it's difficult, right? Because in so many urban centers, and particularly majority Black districts, you have the problem of Maxine Waters and the Democrats like Maxine Waters and white leftists who take the Black vote for granted. And you have the problem, of course, of the well-established problem of the Republican Party sort of conceding those districts to the Democrats. And, you know, if you want to change the composition of the party and broaden its constituency, then you have to make plays in districts like the one you're running in. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hear Republicans talk all the time about, you know, we have to flip California red, but that's going to be absolutely impossible unless we reach into the areas that have been left behind by the Republican Party for a very long time.
Also, we need in the party people like you from South Central, served our country, to perhaps be in leadership positions in the party to be able to speak to the policies that have decimated the inner city over the last 50 years, which you're doing in part in this campaign, including in the context of the George Floyd killing and other incidents that are salient in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. There are tons of policies that have been created by, unfortunately, people like Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton that have been supported by the Democratic Party for a very long time that are used to specifically target black and brown communities. And this is something that needs to be brought aware to the entire United States.
And do you see, you know, it's sort of a combination. It's not just the younger generation, because you've got our friend of the show, Burgess Owens, former NFL or running for Congress in Utah, but you in South Central and John James running again in Michigan. Do you see maybe it's disproportionately younger generation black Americans, but not exclusively, that more reconsideration of the, you know, sort of 95% alignment with Democrats and more black Americans thinking about running for office like you are under the Republican banner?
I think that more people are turning to independent, you know, and,
yeah.
And the reason why is because they're sick of the Democratic Party and the policies that the Democrats have created, but they also, because of the rhetoric that they get from the leftist media, do not want to join a Republican Party because, you know, they have the president viewed as a racist, but every time you approach a Republican, the first thing they want to do is turn their nose up to anyone who has been a Democrat or independent libertarian who wants to join a Republican Party because of, you know, what the president has been doing for our communities. So I think that, you know, although a lot of people want to run for office, they want to run under the independent ticket, which in my opinion is perfectly fine. But I think we need to be more bold and more brave about how we feel about the Republican Party and understand that we're not joining this party to be a part of anybody's establishment, anybody's private club, or anything like that. We're joining because of the values and the history of the Republican Party.
Yeah, and maybe Tim Scott can help provide an example to emulate and make people more comfortable to say, you know, I can identify as a Republican, but work to have the Republican Party be the party that I want it to be, a party that does compete in urban centers and so on and so forth, because I think there's a lot of support for that concept within the party. We just need, you know, more Tim Scotts and more Joe Collins is in public office. That's all. He is Joe Collins. He is he served our country for 13 plus years in the U.S. Navy. He's a candidate for Congress in California 43 against No Justice, No Peace, Maxine Waters. JoeCollinsForCongress.com is the website if you want to help Joe out, and you should. Joe Collins, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with the race.
Thank you. I appreciate it. God bless.
Take care.
That's just the way it is. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Dan Hanninger, writing in the Wall Street Journal, tries to answer the question that I think a lot of people are asking. Why is there so little resistance to what is going on? Why is there so little resistance? How could cancel culture happen in a country with legally protected speech? Why has there been no defense of private property? Which, as he says, remains, believe it or not, a big idea in the minds of foreign-born citizens, from taxi drivers to builders of new companies. The quick collapse of America's elites under this left-wing offensive is a striking and historic event. How did it happen so fast? Why is there so little resistance? Hanninger argues, I think rightly, it was a long time coming. It's been a slow, well, not that slow really in context, but seemingly slow and steady march of the left through all of our cultural institutions. I mean, were you paying attention? I mean, when I was on a college campus 25 years ago, what was the big topic? Speech codes. We had something akin to safe spaces at Northwestern, or certainly the advocacy for them. But this is when Donna Shalala was up in Madison pushing speech codes. and nobody did anything. The acts of denial as liberal traditions eroded were mostly petty self-interests. If you didn't lose your job, you were okay. This is what silences compliance really looks like. Exactly. That's what it really looks like. Silence is compliance. Silence is aiding and abetting violence. That's what the left has been doing for the last 50 years, which is why they now, in their customary fashion, are projecting it onto conservatives. Liberal tolerance, their one cardinal virtue, degraded into rote acceptance, Ray Tenninger. Yes, tolerance and acceptance, not synonyms. Two different words with two different implications. They claim to be defending evolving standards, but eventually there were none. The descent into irrational and illogical claims was impossible to miss. It became obvious that wokeness had turned into a weapon, but liberal leadership blandly let it happen. So now the idea of a functioning consensus about morality of any sort has been erased. By the way, this is an argument that Shelby Steele brilliantly made in White Guilt almost 2 decades ago. You do. So there's no functioning consensus about morality, then no one has moral authority. And as Henninger concludes, about all that's left is smiley face liberalism. With your hate has no home here sign in your yard. Smile. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend and best-selling author, Amity Schley. She's the board chair of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, winner of the Hayek Prize and best-selling author of The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression, as well as Great Society, A New History. And I understand from Amity that a Texas businessman bought a copy of her most recent book on the Great Society for every member of Congress, and it has been delivered. So now the only thing left to do is find someone who will read it to them. Maybe, Amity, you could do story time with Amity for members of Congress so they could ask questions about the complicated concepts in your work.
Not that complicated. Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here with you guys.
Well, they're not that sophisticated. That's the issue. But yes, so congratulations on the continued success of your book. And what do you say to Dan Henninger's distillation of smiley face liberalism?
Well, Dan is one of the sharpest analysts we have in the United States. So I would just kind of add to that. I think the free speech argument is just one argument. The teacher said something. The parents want the teacher fired. The teacher has free speech rights. Okay, but what if the teacher is also correct? For example, when a teacher says, we care about all humans, not just one group. That's correct. Well, the teacher will get dinged for insensitivity in a tough week. Okay. The teacher will be defended because she has the right to say that. And then she may still lose her job. Let's just say the teacher was correct. One, she's a moral leader. So it's a moral abdication.
When we come back with historian Amity Schley, I want to inquire as to how we reestablish the existence of a moral consensus once it's been completely erased. More with Amity Schley coming up.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with historian and best-selling author Amity Schley, and I want to get your take on how you establish moral authority once all moral authority has been conceded. And so how do you reclaim moral authority? How do you reclaim just even, as you say, the truth of the statement that everybody's life matters, and in our country's tradition, we're all equal in the eyes of God, and we all should be equal and equally protected under the law. Why is that right? I don't have any moral authority. You don't have any moral authority. So how do you regain any moral authority? How do you regain any consensus on what the truth is?
It's not us to prescribe, but I would imagine that where responsibility will return will be partly from the churches, where there is some morality. And one of the problems with college is it's kind of a spiritual vacuum often, and kind of weird junk comes in because extreme progressivism or extreme emphasis on race is just a new religion, right? And a less logical one than the old religions that we have. So I do actually believe that.
As I like to say about Illinois and Chicago, it's not broken, it's fixed. That the system actually operated and operates like a lot of people wanted to operate. It wasn't intended to lift people out of poverty. It was intended to create a poverty industry by which you develop beholden constituencies that you use to maintain and expand your political power. And Michael Lind from the University of Texas, who argues that the great divide in this country is the college degree, makes the point about democratic patronage machines that run America's post-industrial cities and the rentiers and firms who feed off of the public sector unions, college-educated professionals, public and nonprofit sectors. They're all part of the Democrat ecosystem. And what they fail to do and why the cities are burning is they failed to figure out how to pay off three groups that make up much of the population in 2020 big urban Democrat cities: the black poor, poor immigrants, and recent college graduates. And that's who you see on the streets. But they figured out how to pay off generations before them and create an industry and political power around them, which is what sustained Democrat control of every city bigger than San Diego for at least the last 50 years, you know, for the most part, with the intermittent Rudy Giuliani or Richard Reardon. So it seems to me we need to be perhaps more pointed about the purposeful nature of what these policymakers and moneyed interests attempted to do and have done in the big cities. And now they just need to figure out how they buy off those that are revolting against them in their own camp.
Okay. But, you know, you mentioned property rights before. I know the evidence suggests, as I mean, this was a terrible learning curve, right, in the 60s. First, we did social work. Then we, you know, we paid for housing, that is rentals. Then we did. And we eventually came to, can't these people get college degrees and be homeowners? That really helped all poor Americans, black and white, to begin to be able to own homes. Nowadays, we tend to say, oh, supporting homeownership didn't work because sometimes that was corrupt and people didn't pay their mortgages, and that had to do with 2008. But that obscures the bigger success of homeownership as the American way for people, whatever ethnicity. That's one of the things I cover in Great Society. What a happy change it was for people to move out of the project and do urban homesteading. So dollar for dollar, I'd rather spend money rather than buying people off to make them quiescent. I'd rather allow them to accumulate capital.
Totally agree. I totally agree. That's what we should do. I'm just arguing that that's not what we're doing, as you argue. And I'm arguing that it's purposeful that we're not doing it. It's not, oh, they're good intentions. They just haven't figured out it's not working after 50 years.
Right. But, well, yeah. And, you know, the Chicago story, part of my book is about Martin Luther King, because he actually came to Chicago to work on housing, as some will remember. And MLK was quite a philosopher, and you can see him, practically see his mind clicking as he's turning over, what do you fight for, tenant rights or home ownership? Oh, maybe houses are what matter. That's one reason he marched in suburbs where it was hard for blacks to buy houses.
Right.
Maybe houses matter more than some kind of play game socialism a la Bertolt Brecht and European film. You know, play game socialism is not American. We are not a class war country. There is no lower class or middle class. I don't even think there's an elite, the word that's used so much now. There's just people who can move up and down and need certain tricks, talents, or skills to do so.
I mean, from your perspective as a historian, because in a lot of there's been a lot of discussion over the last couple of months about 2020 versus 1968. Do you see 2020 and the divisions in this country as more profound and more dangerous than they were in the 60s, or perhaps even at any time since the Civil War?
I don't know about since the Civil War, because we've had some terrible times.
Yes.
I mean, think of the riots in Chicago subsequent to the wars, and think of the sorrows of the Black migration. But it's a tough one, because actually things are better now for most people, including people of color, than they were in the 60s. So what is it that's missing? I think what's mostly missing is a sense of participation. I'm going to say one thing that you'll find odd, but I blame our handling. That would be America's, including Republicans, Republican-led handling of 2008 is a problem, because there was a very cynical bailout of in the financial crisis,
yeah,
of the big rich firms, and the little people sometimes got help and sometimes didn't. We shouldn't have bailed out those firms. There shouldn't be special rules for big firms. If they fail, they fail. And that taught us all, you know, that America was all about who you know and deals, a Chicago on a bad day, right? And not about markets, effort, and prices. And that trickled way down. The other thing I would say is, we all who send our kids to college say, why don't you study accounting? Why don't you study engineering? And one of them studies film. And we say, well, he's like that or she's like that. Ha ha, move on, flip the burger on the grill. This is not benign. We are abdicating when we let them get that kind of education. And then you hear they're afraid of math. Well, anyone can do math. Any idiot can do math. They can just do it a bit more slowly. So, you know, we kind of as parents abdicate and create these undereducated children, pitifully undereducated in the colleges when they go to college, right? So it used to be if you had a college degree, you had to have some respect for statistics. That is no longer the case.
She is Amity Schles, board chair of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, winner of the Hayek Prize and bestselling author of The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. And her new book, Great Society, A New History, which every member of Congress has now. So ask your member of Congress if he or she has read it yet. Amity, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, I'm so glad to be on this show. Thank you.
All in all, you're just another break in the wall.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And champagne socialists, white champagne socialists, you may think you're putting one over on everybody, and you may be putting one over on your colleagues in the D.C. press corps and their junior league outposts around the country, but you're not putting one over on a lot of people, a lot of successful Black Americans. You're not putting one over on them. Robert Johnson, the founder of BET, billionaire, wants you to know that. I don't agree with Robert Johnson everything. I'm not signed on to his reparations plan. But at least he has got the fraud of the guilty white Leninist. He's got that right. And he's happy to expose it. Whether you're in a leafy suburb with a hate has no home here sign in your yard, or you're the scion of one of those people running around helping to pull down statues of people about whom you know very little. Robert Johnson on Fox.
The people who are basically tearing down statues, trying to make a statement, are basically borderline anarchists, the way I look at it. They really have no agenda other than the idea we're going to topple a statue because what? It's not going to close the wealth gap. It's not going to give a kid whose parents can't afford a college money to go to college. It's not going to close the labor gap between what white workers are paid and what Black workers are paid.
Uh-huh.
And it's not going to take people off welfare or food stamps. It's, you know, people having fun that they can go out and pull down a statue and have the mistaken assumption that Black people are sitting around cheering. Black people laugh at white people who do this.
I'm glad. I hope that's true. And remember, The Black experience in America, as portrayed by the D.C. press corps, is not reflective. We've talked about this. We talked about this earlier in the week. The Holman Jenkins piece in the Wall Street Journal about census tracts. It's a very small percentage of the 41 million Black Americans who live in one of the very small number of census tracts where you are facing endemic violence on a daily basis. And so I think the leftist Black intellectuals, activists, vacuous news anchors, they're not representative of what all Black Americans are thinking. That's Robert Johnson's point, and it's a good one.
And so to me, when I see all of this, changing names, toppling statues, firing professors because they said all lives matter, it just shows me that white America is continually incapable of recognizing that Black people have their own ideas and thought about what's in their best interest.
Right. You know what he's telling you. He sees you, white leftist. He knows what you're doing is all about you, and it has nothing to do with aiding the interests of Black Americans. He sees your white guilt. He sees the charade. And so do a lot of us.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and earlier this week, Bill Barr, in an extended interview with Maria Bartiromo. We played clips before, but this bears repeating, particularly in advance of our next guest. This was Attorney General Barr talking to Bartiromo about the social media giants, pending antitrust prosecution of Google, as well as the discussion of removing Section 230 liability protections from the Twitters and the Facebooks of the world.
To some extent, there was a bait and switch over the past couple of decades. These companies held themselves out as open to all comers. That's how they built up all their membership and their networks, saying, you know, we have a wide variety of views. People can come in and post their views and their positions and their statements. And that's what led to people to join it and then get the strong market position they have. Then they've switched. Now they're being more selective. And they're starting to censor different viewpoints. You know, our republic was founded on the idea, and the whole rationale was that there'd be a lot of diversity of voices, and it would be hard for someone to be able to galvanize, you know, a big faction in the United States that could dominate politically and oppress a minority. One way this can be addressed is through the antitrust laws and challenging companies that engage in monopolistic practices.
Another way is by having new entrants to market that challenge the hegemony of the established powers in the particular market. Why don't conservatives or people who believe just in free minds and free markets more generally build their own castles? This is a constant lament among conservatives, among people who do believe in free thinking and free speaking. Maybe one of the remedies to this is a company and a platform called Parler. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by John Mate, who is the founder and iOS developer at Parler. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, this seems to be an opportune time for you to raise the profile on the social media platform that you founded, given the treatment the president is getting at Twitter, as well as all of the exposés that Project Veritas has done on Facebook most recently, but also Twitter. And now with the federal government weighing in as well in advance of the 2020 November election. So what's the pitch for Parler?
Well, so we started to solve a problem with publishers originally, publishers who were actually basically losing their following and losing their revenue because Facebook was changing their algorithm so rapidly. And so every time they changed their algorithm, these companies would lose traffic. And as a result of the traffic loss, they would lose lots of revenue. And what this ended up morphing into is also how kind of we became what we are is, you know, we kind of came in and said, look, we want to be a free speech town square, no fancy algorithms that are going to, you know, ruin people's revenue streams, as well as take anyone's voice away. So, you know, we really wanted to be a town square for actual news, actual conversation, and actual debate without an editorial board like Facebook and Twitter's. I guess they've got their boards that make decisions on moderation, without some kind of editorial board telling you what's politically okay and what's politically not okay.
I know this has been operational for a couple of years now, and how is the progression of adoption going? What are the challenges when you're trying to compete against an established a dominant player like Twitter in this case? How do you advance hashtag Twexit?
Well, Twexit has actually just turned into hashtag Parler, I guess. We started with hashtag Twexit, and that got a lot of popularity about a week and a half ago. It was everywhere. And then now, randomly, we've been trending on Twitter for now going, I think, 48 hours now, just Parler, because everyone has been talking about it. Basically, this week, the way it kind of started out is we announced a partnership with Dan Bongino last week or the week before. That got a lot of traction. And then randomly, Twitter decided it's time to ban Katie Hopkins. She's a figure out in the UK. She's a journalist there. And so when they banned her, people started flooding in the UK to Parler, 200,000 within the first 48 hours. And then now that has turned into a Twexit movement in the United States as well, because they banned Carpe. Carpe is a meme maker. He makes funny videos and funny memes. Most recently, he made a video which was mocking CNN, because CNN showed these two kids. One was black and one was white. And, you know, they tried to basically, his meme was trying to say they were trying to make this look partisan. And he was joking that it wasn't partisan.
Carpe dunked him. Yes, right.
Yes, yes. And so they banned him permanently for that, because they had CNN's imagery on it, and they claimed that it was a violation of CNN's copyright. So he joined Parler, and with him came probably 500,000 people yesterday, and the day before, a lot more people too. I mean, it's been blowing up, and everybody's talking about it now.
And is what's the sort of approach, though? I mean, awareness obviously is a big part of it, but then is the approach to try to leverage personalities to get more and those with big followings on Twitter to come over and, you know, bring a lot of their followers with them to have some of the same conversations that are happening on Twitter, and now just have them on Parler and have them without fear of being shadow banned or fear of being flagged because you have the wrong opinion?
Well, our purpose originally was just to have a town square where if you were able to talk in the middle of New York, in the middle of New York City, in the middle of the street, whatever you could say there and do there, you could do in Parler. That was our goal.
Mm-hmm.
We also wanted to respect people's privacy, so we don't sell data. We don't do anything creepy, right? Because Facebook is notoriously creepy. So is Google and all these other companies. When we look at what's happening today, this has all been organic. There's no like coordinated push of Parler to say, hey, everybody, let's pull some strings and get all these influencers on. This is completely organic. This is genuinely the public, the most active Twitter conservative users saying, this is enough. This is a referendum. This is it. We want our rights. This is the declaration of tech independence.
That's interesting. No, I mean, it's great. Because, you know, action, reaction. I mean, all cliches are true. Every business solves a problem. And the problem you have here is the bait and switch that Attorney General Barr was talking about. And perhaps Parler is perfectly positioned to solve that problem by giving people an alternative town square that is free and open in ways that that sort of thing is just not tolerated. Yeah, it's not tolerated in both physically and virtually in so many places in America now. I think there will be a flight to that sort of quality.
Yes. I mean, there's the whole cancel culture thing. It's if you don't like something somebody has to say, they need to be censored, shut down, they need to lose their job. It's absolutely horrible. You can't have a democratic republic where we elect people based off of, you know, our own perceptions. If you have some big bully in the room, and I call them techno-fascists, that's my term for Twitter and Facebook, because they don't want you to think for yourself. They are sitting there over your shoulder trying to correct you. They're saying, hey, look, no, you can't listen to that person. You can't listen to this because they are not an expert. These are our experts. You have to look at our editorial board we have over here, and they are the ones that are correct. And that's election interference if they're correcting you. And Attorney General Barr is exactly correct. If they came out, you know, in whenever it was, 2006 or whenever Facebook and Twitter were founded, if they came out and said, hey, we're a biased political operative. We censor people because we're a publication. They have been under oath in court stating their publications, too, by the way. If they came out day one and marketed themselves that way, I don't think we'd have a problem here. I don't think they'd be as big as they are now, and I don't think it'd be an issue. And luckily, Twitter is contestable. They don't have as big of a market share as the others. We can take Twitter on. That's not a problem. They failed to monetize. They failed to properly innovate. They're contestable. But Google and Facebook, that's a big beast. And looking at Section 230 is not a bad idea.
Well, and the thing about a Parler too, you'll know you're succeeding when you start being accused of being some sort of platform for conspiracy theorists and the alt-right, which is starting to happen. Then you know you're succeeding.
Oh, yeah.
Because my sense is you take this approach I've always taken. People can call you whatever they want. You're going to be judged on your work product. And so your Parler will be judged on the quality of the conversations and the quality of the contributors and people that set up Parler accounts, just as Twitter and any other platform is.
Yeah. And they already did. I mean, was it 2 days ago? The UK has been really heavy about giving us nasty press. The United States, not so much. But
yet.
We had about 20 plus members of parliament in the UK joined Parler in the last week. And the British press, they've been brutal. They just flamboyantly made stuff up. I mean, they claimed they got in contact with me. They didn't. They never even tried to contact our team. We have no record. They said that we had nasty trending hashtags. We don't even have trending hashtags. So, I mean, all this stuff made up.
Yeah, well, that sounds about right. Well, this is going to be trial by fire, as I'm sure you more than expected, and sounds like you're going to enjoy. All right, so there you go. I got to set up my Parler account. I'm persuaded. John Mate, founder and iOS developer at Parler. That's P-A-R-L-E-R, to set up your own Parler account. John, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We've spent so much time over the last few weeks talking about the human psyche as it pertains to Twitter mobs and vandals and hustlers of all sorts in the public policy and the political arenas. Perhaps a journey into the mind in a productive way, in an interesting way. And that's what we're going to do here with our next guest. She is Maria Konnikova. She is a contributor to The New Yorker, host of the Grift podcast, a visiting fellow at NY's School of Journalism. And all that is a lead up to talk about her as a successful professional poker player. There's a twist. She just released her book, The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. Maria Konnikova, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
This is a very interesting story in one of the last bastions of meritocracy, sports in general, and certainly cards is a sport. I am a very amateur, and by that I mean amateurish, Hold'em player. You are not, self-taught, although with the help of a professional, a mentor, as you write about in your book. Why you moved from being this intellect to applying your intellect to the world of poker?
Well, I wouldn't call it moved so much, because I'm still a writer and it was never meant to be permanent. I actually had no idea that I was going to become a professional poker player. At the beginning of this journey, I didn't even know if I was going to be good at poker. I'd never played before. And I just became fascinated by the notion that there was a game out there that could actually help me disentangle skill from chance, help me look at the limits of skill. You know, where does my control end? And where does chance, where does luck begin? And I thought that poker might be a way into this question because of someone a lot smarter than I am, and that is John von Neumann, the father of game theory. So it ends up that game theory was born out of poker. Von Neumann was a poker player, and he actually hated games in general because he thought they were boring. He said, if you show me something like chess, I can solve it if you give me enough computing power. It's a game of perfect information. Everything's out there. You see all the pieces, you see the whole board. And so at the end of the day, from a human standpoint, from a decision-making standpoint, it's not nearly as interesting to me. Poker is like life. Poker is a game of incomplete information. So there are things I know, there are things you know, there are things we both know.
And we all have to make the best decisions we possibly can in this world of uncertainty. And knowing that there's no such thing as 100%, you are never going to have all the pieces. And yet you still have to act. You still have to decide. How do you do that? What factors do you use? And how do you, at the end of the day, disentangle that from the outcome? Because your goal is to make a good decision. Your goal is to get your money in as a favorite. But then the cards might come against you. So you might get your money in as a 75% favor, and then a 25% happens, and a bad card comes and you lose. That doesn't mean you made a bad decision. So poker really teaches you to spot that difference. And when I saw Mon Moyman's analysis of the game, I thought, this is fascinating. This is what I want to do. I want to learn this. I want to dive into this world for a year. Originally, it was going to be a year. It obviously ended up being a lot longer. I'm going to get one of the best players in the game to teach me, and I'll use it as a way of exploring luck in life.
Interesting thing about this, too, sort of it's a come-as-you-are game, too. So you could have somebody that comes to it the way that you did from a game theory background and with some mentorship. And you have somebody at the table like, I don't, you know, think of other poker greats like Doyle Brunson, who, you know, comes to it through experience and just his own sort of ability to read other people.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I write in the book is that poker is actually one of the most meritocratic environments that I've ever encountered, because it doesn't matter where you went to school or if you even went to school anywhere. If you have the buy-in for the tournament, you can play. And so you really rise or fall on your own merits. And of course, nothing is perfectly meritocratic. Poker, I will just note, it's still 97% male.
Yes,
and
of course.
Female.
Yes.
So there are kind of psychological barriers to entry. And also, of course, it helps if you were born with the privilege to learn to play poker. Maybe a lot of people out there don't even know the game exists. But once you know and once you're in it, I think it's about as meritocratic as they come.
Yeah. I mean, you and Shannon Elizabeth doing wonders for women in poker, at least back when they were broadcasting those poker games on television late at night before the COVID era, when everybody has to be, I don't know, two tables apart or something. We'll see how life resumes in the casinos and the poker rooms. But it's interesting, how you describe that, too, as the environment, right? The environment. So because it's not just understanding, it's not just being a math genius or being able to count cards or being able to run percentages in your mind. It's reading other people, so that there's this human element to it, as you say, the imperfect information, and learning to read people and the cues that people give you as to what they're thinking or how they play the game.
That's absolutely right. And that was actually my main advantage. So even though I was introduced to poker from game theory, my math background is quite limited. The last time I took a math class was in high school. You know, I'm a writer and I have psychology training. So I came from the world of people and human decision making. So that has always been my edge. How do you read the dynamics at the table? And then how do you figure out how they're seeing you? That's also really important. And I think that's so important outside of poker too, being aware of your image. How are other people seeing you? Because it helps you play, so to speak, differently. And in poker, once I realized how certain people thought of me, I could take advantage of it. I could exploit it so that I could win and actually take advantage of their perceptions of me and use that against them. Of course, that works the other way too. I sometimes went terribly wrong when I had preconceptions about certain people at the table. So it's very important to actually look at the information that means something, how someone is playing, how they're acting, how they're reacting, and not to go based on certain biases you might have. I remember one time this guy sat down at the table and he had huge biceps and tattoos. And I thought, oh my God, he's going to be so aggressive. He's going to bully me. I won't let him bully me. And I got into a really bad situation and was told later that this is one of the most conservative players in the world. he doesn't bully anyone. And oops, I couldn't have been more wrong.
That's funny. Well, all right. So now you have to pay it forward, since you were taught by a professional. I need you to come to my monthly hold'em game and help me better read the guys that I play with and become a better player myself. You know, before you become a big star like you're at the final table with Matt Damon in the sequel to Rounders or something like that. This is great. This is an incredible story. It's a fun story. So now are you done on the circuit, or are you going to continue dabbling in this as you continue with your writing career?
I was going to, I mean, I have no desire to stop playing poker. I still love the game. And so I was actually supposed to right now be going to Las Vegas to play in the World Series. My book was originally scheduled to come out in the middle of the World Series, and yeah. I was going to be playing the main event next week. And obviously, as you mentioned, COVID has just wreaked havoc on live poker, and big tournaments can no longer happen because people can't get there. There's no safe way of doing it. And so because I'm a live player, I just don't know when we'll be able to get back to the tables. But when that happens, I'll be there, and I hope that I'll be able to keep both things going because it is a beautiful game, and I still think that it has a lot to teach me. It already has made me a much better decision maker. It's made me know my own mind better. I think it's made me a better person in a lot of ways, more emotionally resilient, more in control of my emotions, someone who's easier to deal with on a lot of levels. And while I still think that it has a lot to give me, why not keep playing? So I do hope that we'll be able to get back to the live poker rooms sometime, maybe in 2021.
I hope so too. It's fantastic. Great story. The book, The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. She is Maria Konnikova, contributor to The New Yorker, host of The Griff Podcast, visiting fellow at NYU School of Journalism, professional poker player. Maria Konnikova, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book and good luck with poker.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And good luck in poker to you as well.
Yes, thank you. Smaller scale, but I appreciate it. Take care.
You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And yesterday, while debating whether or not to debate his legislation, Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina, addressing his colleagues in the Senate, had this to say.
This is a broken process beyond that one piece of legislation. It's one of the reasons why communities of color, young Americans of all colors, are losing faith in the institutions of authority and power in this nation. Because we're playing small ball. We're playing for those in the insulated chambers. We're playing for presidential politics. That's small ball. Playing the big boys game is playing for the kids who can't represent themselves. And if you don't like what you see, change it.
And, of course, he lost that vote to have a debate on his legislation, much less a consideration and an actual vote. And so the beat rolls on, as I talked about earlier in the show, Nancy Pelosi suggesting Tim Scott's legislation, speaking of politics, Tim Scott's legislation was tantamount to being an accomplice to George Floyd's murder. Tim Scott and Senate Republicans are trying to murder George Floyd or are responsible for the murder of George Floyd. That's what Nancy Pelosi said. She had a chance to apologize. She doubled down. It's going to be tough to build consensus on this topic that way, it would seem. But let's get some additional perspective. For that, we're pleased to be joined by Howard Henderson, director of the Center for Justice Research at Texas Southern University, author and editor of the book More Than Race. Howard Henderson, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm glad to be a part of this conversation.
So what did you think of what Tim Scott had to say about, small ball versus the big boys game when it comes to thinking about police reform, at least within the limited realm that the federal government can advance police reform, being that it's mainly a state and local issue?
Well, I think that Tim Scott is doing what he thinks he needs to do to push this issue of police reform forward. There are those who disagree with him, but we are having the conversation nonetheless. And I think that through this conversation, we're going to be able to end up in the right place. But one thing I want to say, though, is I think that just like we dealt with COVID and we're still dealing with COVID-19, and we allowed the experts to provide the positions that we need to determine the situation on, I think we need to also allow the experts to now step in and to make recommendations that the research says we need to make. And that's the reason why we put together at the Center for Justice Research this police reform advisory group, because we knew at some point the politics was going to step in the way. And we want to be a nonpartisan research group to say, listen, this is what is going to work. This is how we know it works. And these are example of places around the country that have done that. So I think the door has been opened. Now the onus is on us as researchers to begin to provide the evidence so the decisions can be made to improve police community relations.
What are some of the data-driven solutions you and your colleagues believe should be advanced or at least given a hard look?
Okay, so very first off, I think also the Democrats and Republicans agree we can deal with no-knock warrants and we can deal with chokeholds. That's very low-hanging fruit. Both parties agree on that. Those two approaches are not necessary to provide effective policing in the community. We can still do what we need to do. We can still protect public safety, but at the same time, reduce disparities by utilizing that very basic approach.
Okay. But where there's disagreement, I mean, is there something that is particularly important yet also controversial that would perhaps be a game changer or you believe is an integral part of anything under the umbrella of police reform that is hotly contested?
Yeah, so we're looking at qualified immunity. That is going to be a huge point of contention.
Right.
Because I don't think that there's going to be disagreement that something needs to be done. The challenge is going to be at what point do we begin to erode those protections? Because there's a very fine line that you want police to be protected in order to do their job, but you don't want them to be protected enough to be able to get away with gross abuses that we've been able to see on TV. But that's going to be a very difficult position to make some agreement and some headway on. But I think that is going to be the biggest bone of contention. The other issue is going to be funding. This entire defund the police movement, the optics on that are very difficult for some Americans to swallow. There are some people who are on the extreme left who are saying that, guess what? We want to totally get rid of police. And there are others who are saying, no, we want to fund them more. They got to figure out at what point they're going to be able to agree on that. So I think that funding is going to be that second issue that's going to be a serious bone of contention.
Well, that's a good segue for when we come back to talk a little bit from the bottom up, as we've been talking about from the federal government down to this point. More with Howard Henderson, director of the Center for Justice Research at Texas Southern University, author and editor of the book More Than Race. And that Center for Justice Research is put together to address police reform at the national level. More with Mr. Henderson.
I want to fly like an eagle to the sea.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Howard Henderson on The Dan Proft Show. Mr. Henderson is the director of the Center for Justice Research at Texas Southern University and author and editor of the book More Than Race. And we left off our conversation about funding, but let's talk a little bit about, the context in which police reform has to happen. Police departments are local institutions. They're part of municipal governments, generally speaking, setting aside state police for a minute. They're generally part of municipal governments, particularly in big cities that have more diverse populations and a higher incidence of violent crime. But it's not necessarily on a per capita basis, always the big cities, as you know. How do you advance police reform, or why haven't police reforms been advanced when there seems to be general agreement about some of those things with respect to the civilian power structure that the police report to? I mean, why is it the federal government needs to come in and tell Mayor Lightfoot in Chicago, Mayor Garcetti in L.A., Mayor de Blasio in New York, what they need to do with respect to their police departments when, for example, Chicago is already sort of voluntarily operating under a consent decree from the previous presidential administration. To me, one of the pieces that's lost in this conversation is the responsibility and the accountability of the civilian political authorities to which the police chief and the police department report.
I think that one of the biggest challenges that impedes the ability of the system to be progressive is the fact that every city sort of does their own thing in terms of criminal justice. There is no standard. And so there should be a standard by which we operate. Even in each state, every police department has the liberty to choose the way in which they operate. And so I think that if we're going to see the standards improved, if we're going to be able to hold police departments more accountable, we got to be able to have a baseline from which we're able to assess the ability of the police to be effective in the community to respond accordingly.
So does that mean licensure, or is certification, as Tim Scott has advocated for, is that sufficient?
No, I think it's a start. If you look at the federal government, they have their law enforcement meets a basic standard. I think there's going to need to be a standard that's set across the board from everything from use of force, hiring practices. You know, we need to make sure that when a police officer is hired, that they meet this level of the expectation and qualification that's not subjective to local nuances, because they're all actualizing and protecting the Constitution as we see fit.
Well, yeah, well, the Constitution argument, that's an interesting argument. But I mean, in terms of hiring decisions, you want that? You want a federal standard imposed on municipal police departments in terms of the guidelines that, well, not the guidelines, the law they must abide with respect to hiring?
Well, no, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is there should be a level of expectation that we should all be looking for. Now, again, you know there are going to be differences that are affected by local reality. For example, the hiring pool. You need to be able to say, if everything was perfect, we want you to be at this level. There are exceptions to every rule. I think the exceptions should be clearly laid out, but I think there should be a standard. If you look in some of these cases, when you find a lot of these police officers who are involved in these egregious cases, a lot of them have 10, 15 prior cases. Those individuals need to be identified and removed from American policing. I'm not talking about creating a national standard where everyone has to meet that standard.
Okay.
What I'm saying is to create your bar where people understand this is what we should be achieving and looking for.
And I like the idea of standards, but sort of norms in the sense of standards, too, and say, you know, this is an agreement by which we're going to measure ourselves. That makes some sense to me as a starting point. And then you argue about what's the component parts of those standards are. That makes sense. Thinking about this at the local level again, I mean, the point here, as you mentioned, is number one, to protect people, protect and serve people and protect their constitutional rights and correspondingly their public safety interests. And I wonder if you think that some of the discussion going on now about police reform, including on the topic of qualified immunity, which Attorney General Barr suggested would drive a lot of people from the police force, and with the resignations you see on police forces around the country, if you're worried at all that the nature of the conversation can move in such a direction that you lose good people from police forces currently or from a desire to be a police officer prospectively.
I think that you're going to have a few officers who are not going to want to enter law enforcement when they know there's no qualified immunity. And you're going to have a few officers who would leave law enforcement because they no longer have qualified immunity. But I don't think the total elimination of qualified immunity is the answer. I think you can alter that in a matter of degrees.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few cases where we can all agree is inappropriate. We could identify those as exceptions to the qualified immunity protection. I think that is going to be the path of least resistance. But to totally get rid of qualified immunity, I think, is unfeasible. And you put police officers in a position where, you just mentioned before, you're going to have good officers, some of them who would want to leave. So I think you identify those cases where there are exceptions to the qualified immunity protection, and you'd be able to appease both sides and maintain the ability to retain good police officers.
I keep coming back to this program. You were talking about what the Center for Justice Research does at Texas Southern, and you know, look at best practices, look at models around the country that should be replicated or scaled as is possible. And I keep coming back to John Ponder's Hope for Prisoners program in Las Vegas, where it seems like the key to his success with reducing recidivism among ex-offenders is putting police in fellowship with ex-offenders. So not only protecting and serving, but protecting, serving, and living in fellowship with those you protect and serve and even arrest. And that's John Ponder's experience, too, as an ex-offender. And I wonder if part of the conversation about policing needs to be writ large, police working and living in fellowship more with the communities they protect and serve, and that going in both directions.
I think that's very important, because the more that we can improve the positive interaction, the least likely we are to have these use of force cases. The research shows us very clear and unequivocally that there is a relationship between your disconnect from the community and the use of force that you may express on the job. So we have to understand that we got to figure out a way to motivate officers living in these communities. A lot of officers are totally disconnected. When they get off work and leave shift, they're going to live in another part of town. They have no relationship with the individuals that they protect and serve. There are a few cities that are incentivizing officers moving in neighborhoods with housing vouchers in one sort, but we're going to have to figure out a way to beef up those programs and come up with creative ways, like you mentioned John Ponder's approach, which is a great approach.
He is Howard Henderson. He's the director of the Center for Justice Research at Texas Southern University, author and editor of the book More Than Race. Great conversation. Thanks for joining us. Hopefully we'll continue it again in the near term. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Closing out today's installment, the prospect of Major League Baseball beginning July 23rd or 24th, 60-game season. Exciting to get sports back, particularly a professional sport that has, to its credit, don't want to jinx it, largely stayed out of politics, which is super helpful. One indication that it stayed out of politics. I bet most people listening could name the NFL commissioner. I bet a lot of people listening could name the NBA commissioner. I bet very few people listening could name Major League Baseball's commissioner. That's a good thing, particularly if you're a sports fan and you see sports as a refuge from politics, which it should be in large measure. This is not a shut up and dribble argument. This is just sports as a escape from the vagaries of everyday life, including our relatively dismal politics. That's all. You're an athlete. You got an opinion. Go ahead and share it. You're an American citizen. You're a free, self-actualized person, just like anybody else. But if you want to hyper-politicize your sport in one direction the way the NFL does, then I got to tell you, I'm going to be less interested in following it. I don't care how good you are at it. And so thinking about baseball and being concerned that there'll be pressure from some baseball players to go the direction of LeBron James or Colin Kaepernick. We'll see. We'll also see if they have fans, because as you have with COVID-19 policy more generally, you've got different states and communities looking at it differently. For example, in Texas, the Rangers GM is and the politicians there looking at having fans. Season ticket holders getting first priority, stadium 50% capacity. In Chicago, where I live, White Sox are planning to play in front of fans. Cubs may as well. The scuttlebutt, and it's only that at this point, is that, for example, where the White Sox play, guaranteed rate field, or the G-spot as I call it, they would limit the stadium to 20% capacity, which would be like 8,000 fans. Now, that's one thing. And then the whole thing is, well, what is the fan experience, even if they do allow fans? The talk right now, requirement to wear masks. Okay, I'm out. Temperature checks before being allowed entry. 6-foot distance markers throughout, like you see in retail and commercial properties. Seating staggered. Maybe netting around the entire stadium so that fans don't chase foul balls and violate social distancing strictures. Also, the possibility that concession and merchandise stands and clubhouse stores would all be closed. Those are all possibilities. Those are being discussed now as every community tries to come to grips with this a little bit differently. But, I mean, if you have to wear a mask and you can't get a beer and a dog at a ball game, are you going to go? I'm a White Sox season ticket holder. I don't think I will. Maybe even if I could bring my own, the mask, that's a deal breaker for me. You're outdoors. I'm not doing theater, not for 3 hours while I try and take in a ball game. Thanks for joining us on another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Please do so again tomorrow.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.